Hello and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets podcast. I'm Mark Robinson, filling in for John Heumann, our editor, who's away on a holiday in Austria, Vienna, I think, maybe Salzburg or perhaps even Brno. I'm joined in the studio today by the IC Features editor, Alex Newman, and our news editor, Emma Powell. Emma is also the author of this week's cover features, looking at the performance of the UK's high street banks against their challenger rivals and how that's changed since the global financial crisis. But before we come on to the main show, we can just have a look at some of this week's news output with Alex and Emma, if she wants to chime in as well. I guess there's an overarching regulatory theme to the magazine this week. Our first news article concerns Anglo American, the miner. And there's been some bad news this week, Alex, not related to its African assets, though.
Yeah, for once, it's not the South African assets which appear to be in trouble, but it's the Minas Rio iron ore operation in Brazil, where over the Easter weekend, operations were suspended because a leak connecting the mine to an export terminal in Rio de Janeiro was found. So they're going to have to do a 90-day inspection of the pipe. It's pretty costly. It also means that obviously they can't produce anything. So this mine, they produce iron ore in slurry form, and then it's piped out. So this is, it was pretty annoying for Anglo American, because they haven't got too many big growth projects on at the moment, but Minas Rio is definitely one of them. So this is where they're hoping to pretty much triple capacity in the next 3 years.
I think the delays at that mine as well were part of the reason why Cynthia Carroll eventually had to resign her post as chief executive.
Yeah, and then it came on stream in 2014, just as iron ore prices were dropping to their worst in many, many years.
So they're actually thinking of selling that at some point, or at least considering it, I believe.
Yeah, but I mean, it's now very much part of their, at least in terms of their corporate literature, very much part of their future growth plans, even though there are, there's quite a lot of dampened sentiment for iron ore prices.
Yeah, I guess part of that is probably they want to diversify away from their African assets a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And Brazil, I think, is still a fair degree of geopolitical risk. Perhaps that's the tier that Anglo-American is just a bit more comfortable in when you compare it to the likes of Rio Tinto, which tends not to go into certain jurisdictions because there is a elevated geopolitical risk. Anglo, perhaps the differentiating factor is that they're not too afraid.
What's the likely financial hit? Do we know from this current problem?
So last year, Minas Rio generated about $200 million in earnings before interest and taxes. This year, it was planning on expanding production quite considerably. So 3 months out is going to, just back of an envelope calculation, it's probably going to mean it's going to be hard for the mine to generate those sort of earnings for the whole year, even though it was probably expecting to make a 50% higher than that. So it is a bit of a hit. And then obviously there's the cost associated with doing the pipeline checks as well. So a bit of a setback. And then I suppose the broader news, which has actually hit the share price a bit harder this week, has been the ongoing threats to global trade and the
because China have come back this week against the US, haven't they?
Yeah. So today's Thursday. It's it looks like we're still no closer to negotiations, but this tit for tat trade war rhetoric is escalating, and obviously miners and commodity suppliers are at the forefront of the threat, really, because if there's a threat to global economic growth, then there will be certainly a threat to
all the primary producers, really. Yeah, that's quite disturbing, but I don't know, we'll have to see how that one pans out, really. But it's obviously something that all our readership should be keeping their eyes on at the moment. As many of our readers know, we go to press on a Wednesday, and Harriet Russell had written up a story looking at conviviality, specifically their transition to a wholesaler, and what part that may have played in their downfall. And at that point, we were under the impression that they brought the administrators in, but that changed late in the day, didn't it, Emma?
Well, yeah, news broke quite late in the day that some of the workers, at least, they're employees of the wholesale business, Matthew Clark and Bibendum, have been thrown a bit of a lifeline because CNC have made an offer, basically, to buy that business.
That's the Irish drinks producer.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're coming in the 11th hour as well. They're going to have a little bit of leverage on those deals too. So presumably it works out in their favour. But we would imagine there's still going to be some... That act hasn't played out fully for conviviality at this stage. I would imagine that management will remain under pressure. This week's new spotlight was actually written by Alex as well. And it's a rather unusual take. This has a sort of regulatory theme to it. So it's an unusual story for the IC, Alex. It's an analyst personnel move. What's the story and how come we're writing about it?
Yeah, so the story is Barclays head of utilities, or the chap who heads up, or used to head up until very recently, the research that Barclays puts out on European utilities has left to join a financial think tank called Carbon Tracker. It's, I suppose, unusual because we don't normally report on the comings and goings of personnel at research houses and brokerages. But we spoke with Mark Lewis, who's made the move, and it's quite an interesting move for two reasons. The first being the changes in the banking sector, which I know Emma's written a lot about in the last few months, and specifically MiFID II rules, which has had quite a shake up in the way brokerages sell their research to asset managers and, you know, the big institutional investors who buy their research.
So they've actually about transparency. This is
yeah. So the goal is transparency in financial markets. But what the sellers of the research are having to do is unbundle them from all the other transactions they make with banks and with their clients. So it means that it's a harder job to sell the research, presumably, and it's going to be more scrutiny from the buyers of the research. So it comes at an interesting time there, and Mr. Lewis did say that that was partly a push factor. And the pull factor is that has created a bit of a gap in the market, so he thinks, in terms of the research that could be provided from alternative research providers that aren't regulated by, you know, these banking regulations. And so to have joined a think tank that focuses on climate change, in which he says, you know, in ways that the investment banking community has failed to anticipate. Yes, it's quite another interesting thing.
Well, it could have some potentially beneficial implications as well, because one of the criticisms of sell-side research is that it may be tainted by, there might be compromised by the other commercial interests that these investment houses have.
Yeah. I mean, that's not necessarily pointing fingers.
Chinese walls
directly,
are
yeah. But aside. I mean, indeed. So the idea of a Chinese wall, where a brokerage can act on behalf of a company and gain, you know, millions in investment banking fees, and at the same time putting out a research report on the company, it's not hard to see the inevitable skewering of the opinion. The other the other element to research, which I often come across in the case of the oil and gas sector, which I struggle with, is that it's research is often written on a sort of 12-month forward basis, so it's about the return that investors can expect on a pretty short time horizon. What we do at the Investors Chronicle is try and look at a little bit longer than that, and certainly when it comes to sectors like European utilities, which have had a dreadful decade, or oil and gas, which we'd expect is going to have a very, very tough couple of decades ahead of it, is that really 12-month forward-looking research reports don't really do... you know, tell you a lot of the picture. And certainly if I was investing in oil and gas stocks, I would want to have a lot further time horizon.
Well, if you'd have asked me 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago, I would have struggled to believe that unit costs for renewables are now economically viable.
Yeah,
and I think that was pretty much true. That was pretty much the consensus amongst the advisors at this stage.
So 10 years ago, the common consensus was that subsidies were required for indefinitely for renewables to be able to compete with fossil fuels. That's now no longer the case. I mean, in some areas of solar, subsidies are still needed. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly reaching parity. Yeah, I mean, what this means for retail investors is another, I suppose, interesting question. Emma, I know when you wrote your feature on regulation a few weeks ago with Harry, you spoke about how this might affect smaller companies, particularly if there's a dearth of research there, then that could lead to sort of quite volatile share price swings. But, you know, I suppose many of our listeners and readers don't actually get access to a lot of this research anyway. So, I mean, perhaps it's much of a muchness to lots of people out there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other argument would be for the kind of small cap companies that actually it makes estimating, you know, forward earnings a lot harder. So maybe, I don't know, investors may have less to go on in terms of a consensus estimate. That is the other argument that I heard. I wrote a feature on the future of equity research, actually, just it was about a year ago now, before the rules came into force. And that was certainly the argument, that not only would it maybe obscure or just mean that fewer analysts were obviously contributing to a consensus estimate, but that, yeah, it would maybe create more volatile share prices.
Yeah, you've got to wonder who the investment houses are pitching towards as well, because you often find with small cap fledgling companies, they've got very limited coverage. In many cases, it's just the one analyst who happens to be the house analyst as well. So that's no sort of coverage at all, really. But you know, we were minded that there would be a lot of companies pulling out of the small end of the market, especially those companies that have a very poor secondary market. And that's true of a great many AIM companies as well. But it's certainly one to watch there. I think, as your article pointed before, because it could have some an unusual take on investment. As you say, I mean, this carbon tracker, for instance, would be more inclined to look at long-term trends as well. And, you know, it would have effect across a range of industries, not only oil and gas.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if the views of alternative research providers are somehow elevated or fill a bit of a vacuum that's left behind by, you know, reduction in some of the typically sector-by-sector bullish investment banking coverage. But yeah, I mean, it's still early days for MiFID II, so it remains to be seen, I suppose.
Okay, continuing on with the regulatory theme, as this week's cover feature was written by Emma, as I mentioned before, and she's been looking at the banks or the sector following the global financial crisis. I mean, I guess at the time we became aware that things weren't well in that particular sector, you'd have just been starting university at that point.
I think I was doing my A-levels.
You may well have been. You may well have been. But I get the takeaway from an individual investor's point of view is that they, at that point, when it became obvious that there were serious problems regarding capitalization and risk management in the banking sector, that actually took away what had become a reliable or predictable plank in many investors' portfolios as well. To think that banks were facing an existential crisis was unheard of in most people's lifetimes. I guess if you went back to 29 and the failure of the US banks following the Wall Street crash, and there'd been periodic problems ever since. But it engendered change as well, because there's been a number of licenses granted since 2010, I believe.
Yeah, there's been a lot. I mean, like you said, the big major kind of banks, the big five, were major income stocks. They were in a lot of people's portfolios. And that's still true to some extent, although I would say, you know, that's primarily like Lloyd's and things like that is very well held still. Others not so much. But the major banks are unrecognisable to a certain extent than they were, you know, pre-financial crisis. But it is interesting at the moment. I think we have reached a bit of a turning point.
Is it inflation or macro? I mean, the main point of this article is looking at how valuations for those big high street banks has started to recover in relation to the challenges.
Yeah, so kind of it has been a bit of an inflection point, because the big high street banks were almost like untouchables, some of them certainly. But during the past kind of 12 months, we have seen on a forward price to book ratio that they have started to re-rate, while actually the opposite is true for the vast majority of the challenger banks.
Okay, what are the reasons for this? Why are we seeing some kind of a resurgence in terms of the valuations?
Well, I think the main reason is because so much of the narrative around the big banks, and rightly so, for the past decade has been on strengthening the balance sheet. It's getting rid of these risk-weighted assets. you know, simplifying their structures, particularly in the case of Lloyds, Barclays, although they have kept a much smaller investment bank, and obviously RBS. It's been really kind of getting rid of a lot of the bad debts. You know, in the case of RBS, it's winding up their bad bank, which is Capital Resolution, which they have now done last year. So I think so much of the narrative has focused on that and increasing their capital levels that, because they've made so much progress in that area, and we've seen that in the 2017 results, you know, they're across all the major lenders, their core tier one capital ratios have increased to such an extent that, for instance, Standard Chartered, which had cancelled their dividend, managed to reinstate it. I mean, it's very meagre, but still. Barclays, which has been the laggard of the sector, after cutting their dividend, now this year they're going to be reinstating the 6.5p a share dividend. So, you know, you're seeing those capital levels increase and signs perhaps of their income status coming back into play.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised that it's taken so long for the banks to recover, because in just about all that period as well, they've been operating in a low interest rate environment, which is obviously unfavourable for them. But I guess they're in no position to argue as well, because the general debate was following the crisis is whether, because of the effective repeal of most of the Glass-Steagall regulation in the US, whether the investment arm should be broken away. That didn't happen for the global banks. And so they've been forced effectively to toe the line there. You're saying that the capital ratios have come back up now as well, but are they showing growth in the normal areas of banking as well?
Well, that's the interesting thing, and this is the point I make. So, you know, you look at the way that the capital ratios are calculated, and yes, they've reduced their risk-weighted assets at a very at a massive rate during the past decade. But the thing is that on the other side of things, when it comes to equity generation, unsurprisingly, that's been very weak. I mentioned Barclays, that they're reinstating that 6.5p dividend, and their capital ratio has improved a lot. But the main reason for that is because the risk-weighted assets have reduced a lot, not because they're making good returns on equity, very, very weak returns on equity. And that's, you know, that's unsurprising when interest rates are so low. Barclays hasn't been helped by the fact that its investment bank has been hurt very badly as well. And they have to obviously hold a lot of tangible equity against that. So on that side, we've got them reducing their risk-weighted assets, cleaning up their balance sheets. On the bear side, with the major lenders, their returns on equity are still very weak.
And plus, they've been assailed by one-off costs as well, regulatory failures, PPI being the most prominent amongst them.
Although on that front, again, with the PPI, the deadline for claims against that is August 2019. So that's another positive for these UK retail banks, that a line is going to be drawn underneath that.
It's probably just as well, in a sense, as well, that their houses are coming back into order, because they're also faced now with a medium to longer term challenge as a result of technical change as well. The rise of fintech, and this has been particularly pronounced in the United Kingdom as well, and technology such as blockchain promise to change the face of retail banking.
Yeah, retail banking in 10, 20 years' time, I think it's going to look nothing like it does today. I mean, we've already seen so many of the, you know, the high street banks closing branches. You can see why. They've got to cut costs at the end of the day. So they have, actually just in the latest set of results, Barclays, Lloyds, Virgin Money, which is a challenger, just as a side point, they have actually announced lots of investment into digital banking, because that is so much, you know, that's got to be such a big part of their future business plans.
Yeah, I think is certainly with your generation as well, there's a far greater aptitude in terms of using digital technology, accessing your financial records that way. So as old codgers like me actually die off, I mean, it will become the default banking position.
Well, yeah, I mean, branches and employing staff there are very expensive to run.
I remember the days of passbooks. You wouldn't even know what I was talking about there, would you?
No.
Okay, so Emma, we've covered what you describe as a turning point in the market as well, and we've looked at the improved capital ratios for the high street banks as well. Their valuations have improved on the back of this and are set to stabilise. But the opposite is true of the challenges. Is it just a relative point at the moment, or why have they derated?
Well, challenger banks, as you mentioned earlier, I think there are about 90 new banking licences issued by the Bank of England
since 2010.
Between 2010 and 2017. So when the high street banks kind of withdrew from some specialist areas of lending, they had to lower their risk profiles. A lot of these challenger banks came into play, and a lot since have listed, and they've done brilliantly. And the kind of return on equity that they've been posting, the loan book growth, it's been phenomenal. Hence why they've always traded at quite a hefty premium traditionally to the high street banks. That has now started to come off slightly, particularly during the past 6 months. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I mean, firstly, you get banks like One Savings Bank, Charter Court, which is a newly listed one, Aldermore, which actually is now kind of delisted, but they focus very much on kind of very highly cyclical markets, namely buy to let and residential mortgages.
Yeah, because there isn't one size fits all with challenger banks, is there?
Yeah, that is a good point. We say challenger bank, but actually it's everything from a One Savings Bank buy-to-let specialist to Virgin Money, which grows, concentrates on kind of credit cards and things like that, to Metro Bank, which truly is a challenger bank, you could say, because they focus high street retail banking.
And they're opening branches as well.
And they're opening branches, which is a very odd kind of growth plan, in my view. But anyway, but yeah, so I think firstly, the fact that they operate in very cyclical markets and, you know, they aren't very diversified, some of them. So I think in the case of One Savings, you can see why they've derated, because, you know, investors will be a bit more nervous about that. The buy-to-let market has contracted. I think the other reason is because we have seen margin pressure, particularly for kind of challenger banks like Secure Trust, Close Brothers. They're operating in areas like asset finance. They do some mortgages as well, but particularly in the asset finance market and also lending to kind of SMEs, the term funding scheme set up by the Bank of England in 2016, that basically made a lot of cheap funding available to banks. So it meant a lot more lenders kind of rushed into the marketplace because it made it easier for them to basically, you know, lend. And, you know, if you talk to Paul Lynham, who's chief exec of Secure Trust, he'll say that it was because these banks basically haven't been pricing risk properly. So we've got a very, you know, crowded marketplace.
This is another consequence of the fact that we're dealing with historically low interest rates.
Yes, I mean, I would say That's true to a certain extent, but I would say with the challenges, it's more the fact that we've got a lot more of this cheap funding available. So it's easier for me to accelerate my loan book and kind of undercut people on margin. So they've seen a lot of margin pressure, which I think has also kind of spooked investors.
Yeah, I don't think the government would be quite so generous if interest rates were chugging along at 4% and 5%, though. You know, I mean,
Sorry. Of course, the reason why the term funding scheme was introduced was because, following the referendum, the base rate was slashed to such an extent that, you know, they thought we'll kind of take with one hand and give with the other and help you out a bit.
There's since the global financial crisis as well, there's been, as you say, this has been unprecedented in the number of banking licenses granted in the UK, but there's also been an appreciable rise in alternative financing sources as well, across the board. And you think there's a finite space there, and we've been operating in a very unusual environment there. So I would be minded there will be some attrition within the sector at some point. What are out of the challenger banks as well? Are there any that you think have got better long-term prospects?
Yeah, I definitely do think so. I mean, I mentioned, you know, margin pressure and cyclical markets, but actually take One Savings Bank, for instance. You know, they do operate primarily in buy-to-let, but the thing is they cater to professional landlords that do set up limited companies can obviously maintain the buy-to-let mortgage interest relief, which was a big reason a lot of amateur kind of buy-to-let landlords have left the market, which has been one of the reason the market has contracted. They're posting very high. I mean, it's like best in class. It's, I think it was 26% return on equity, which is, I haven't heard of one higher from any of the other banks. It's brilliant. They do pay a dividend. I think they yield on a forward basis. It's around 3.4%. And they are trading at a discount. And I think over the longer term, you know, they've shown, you know, even last year, that they've shown that they can continue to grow their loan book. They flagged some slightly higher costs because obviously the term funding scheme did come to an end in February. But I think over the long term, they've got their kind of specialism nailed, which is really good. I would also say just another one, Secure Trust. You know, yeah, they've kind of flagged, well, Secure Trust and Close Brothers actually have flagged some margin pressure. But I think why I like both of them is they've been very conservative. You know, they haven't just tried to write new business at any cost, which I think is really important.
Okay, so that's obviously favourable from a risk management perspective as well. Anyway, it's a really interesting piece, and I guess it's the story. It's an unfolding story at this point as well, but it is interesting that after so many years that our readership might like to take a second look at those high street lenders. Elsewhere in the magazine this week, it's a bit of a family affair for the Boxalls. Megan Boxall has been writing about the prospects for M&A within the pharmaceutical sector. And her father, Chris, has written a piece for us looking at some of the pitfalls of investing in the AIM market in London. Elsewhere in the magazine, we have another investment trust write-up from John Barron. Christello's talking about inflation. And in the stock screen this week, Algie Hall is looking at 8 low-risk, high-yield shares. So that's it for another week until John returns from Austria. So thank you very much, Alex, and thank you, Emma, and goodbye to all our readers.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.